I think when we talk about breaking barriers, we are talking about breaking barriers and moving on to a world that has true freedom. And that is why we thought that the topic that I was given, Walking Together for Freedom, was very appropriate. It is also appropriate to invite somebody like me, because I come from a country which is at war with itself. It has internal tensions, and it has external hostilities, which perpetually threaten the country, and in turn, those that are masters of our country threaten the public with the external, the possibilities of the external hostilities, and make that into an excuse of usurping our rights. So on the one hand, they are fighting for our security. On the other hand, they are taking away our very security and our very dignity. One would ask, what is there to be done in Pakistan? And I know several of my colleagues have said to me, well, let's give up. It's just too complicated and too complex for us. And I recall many years ago, when I first time I went to prison and I came out, my daughter, who was very young at that time, was very upset that I had gone to jail, and said to me, why do you do this? Why do you continuously keep going to police stations and jails? I can assure you that if you didn't do it, women's rights would come. They will come without you. With you there, they may come only an hour earlier. So why do you have to leave us? But I think we are all fighting for that hour earlier. And I believe that we cannot give up. And I also know that simply lack of violence is not peace. Or the presence of violence itself does not mean that we are at war. We have no option but to address this global phenomena of hostilities and violence and polarization, to rejuvenate the peace movements. And I agree that peace and justice must go hand in hand. We have to accelerate it. We have to widen the peace movement in all directions. And when I say that peace and justice must go hand in hand, because we heard several times in Pakistan that the Taliban were there, at least the people of Afghanistan have peace. And I do recall one of the politicians coming to the television station and saying over TV, yes, it is of peace, but it is the peace of the graveyard. And we do not want the peace of the graveyard. There were all signs, the warning signs were there, that it is going to erupt. That horrible, silent peace was going to erupt. It was going to make the world a noisier, a more disruptive world. But what happened to the leaders of the world? Why were preventive measures not taken? And these are the questions that we as peacemakers have to put to the leadership of the world. These are the questions that we have to shake them up with. No longer will old sanctions and the regime of sanctions work. It has to be smart sanctions, where people do not suffer, but those that violate peace must suffer. I know that there are many tools in the hands of governments. There are many initiatives that they can take, even softer ones, against those who are perpetrators against peace. But those so far have not been taken. It is also important for us to understand that we are living in an interconnected world. If the US is not at peace, I will not be at peace in Pakistan. If the US is following an agenda for security, that agenda will be followed by other countries as well. And if there is no peace in Rwanda, there will be no peace in Africa. And if there is no peace in Africa, there will be no peace in Asia. So none of us can be complacent in thinking that we are living in an hour immediate environment of peace. I just want to take you to some of the initiatives that we took, women from India and Pakistan, particularly because women peacemakers are here. We've always thought that negotiating tables, wars, and peace are for men, and it is men's domain. But I begin to feel more and more that women have a significant role to play in peace building. I recall that when India detonated its atom bomb, we followed suit, and all borders were closed, telephone lines were cut, but people through the internet communicated with each other and condemned the detonation of the atom bomb. And that was one of the first times that at least young peacemakers got together from India and Pakistan. You know that we have been to war several times, but during the last war, which was a Kargil war, a useless, senseless war, where the military then stepped in, removed the civilian elected leader, there was such hostility between India and Pakistan, people have stopped going, trains had stopped running between the two countries, even flights were not operating between two countries. And it was at that time that women decided that they must break that silence, that horrible Cold War, which was eating up our societies. And for that, I have brought a small little clip for you to see how women from both sides of the border and peacemakers, not just women, it was then even men came on board and were there to help us, even initially, how in very difficult circumstances we have sort of extended our hands to each other and given a message so that policymakers begin to understand that people-to-people dialogue and people-to-people meeting and people-to-people understanding has gone so far, has developed to a depth where they will not sit quiet if one army is fighting against the people of the other country. So I would just want you to show you that clip because it was made by my office who insisted that I must play it for you.
दिखाई देते हैं दूर तक अब भी साए कोई मगर बुलाने से वक्त लौटे ना कोई.
Freedom must be enjoyed universally, and there can be no freedom without peace, internal or external. Pakistan is a prime example where winds of freedom are hostage to forces of hatred and hostility. India and Pakistan have lived as two warring neighbors. This has affected the flourishing of freedom in both countries. India's democracy and secularism has been consistently undermined by religious right wing, who justify anti-Muslim sentiments on the plea that they remain emotionally loyal to Pakistan. Pakistan remained a security state on the plea of hostilities at the border. Peace builders of Pakistan and India, including women, led the movement for a people-to-people contact. This forced the hand of both governments to hold negotiations. These often are abruptly discontinued after some violent incident. Pakistan and India had gone to war three times before they conflicted over Kargil, and the peace movement took a severe setback. It was the women of both countries who broke the cycle of disengagement. A bus full of Indian women peace activists visited Pakistan amidst a hostile climate at home. In return, two buses of Pakistani women peace activists visited India to call for dialogue. It renewed interaction, and the medium of culture was used as an instrument of bonding. Because of both countries, that the people of India and Pakistan welcome the initiatives for the promotion of peace. The doves outnumber the hawks. There is also a realization that human rights can alone thrive alongside peace. Democracy cannot deepen in an atmosphere of war and conflict. Issues cannot be resolved through silence and disengagement. Well, this was just made by friends who realized that I was coming here and felt that I often just take off with my notes. And so to make the lecture a bit more palatable, I need to have some distraction as well. But what they missed showing here, which I regret very much, is the singing, is the way that women both sides sang to each other. And one of the most popular songs was, "Look, sisters are coming, having broken all their bonds. Tod tod ke bandhanon ko dekho bhene aayi hain, naya zamana laayi hain." That they will bring in a new change, and they will bring in peace. And then there was, we have same kind of jokes. And you saw at one point that there is a theater group that is performing at the border. There was a time when we were beaten up when we went at the border. On the 14th of August is our Independence Day. 15th of August is India's Independence Day. So we used to take candles and meet there facing each other. And we were beaten up badly. But next year we went again. And this time we took a play with us that was critical of militarization, that was critical of war, and this theater group performed while the army looked on, absolutely horrified at what we were doing, and we had to keep telling them it's just going to end, and it ended 20 minutes later. So I believe that peace activists, and in fact, human rights activists, have to continuously push the envelope. Nobody is going to give us opportunities just on a platter. We have very recently also witnessed tensions between countries in the West or societies, some societies in the West, and particularly what happened in my country and what happened in Libya. And I believe that it is important to talk about it because it has polarized society. We have seen that the role of non-state actors has increased, and they can, in fact, play either a very positive or a very destructive role in putting societies together, in bringing them closer, or bringing them apart. The video that was displayed on YouTube, which I have not seen, but reportedly was derogatory to the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and exhibited with the purpose of wounding the sentiments of the Muslims. The outrage in some instances was violent and I believe counterproductive. This has brought the debate in public sphere, but this debate has been going on against such vicious acts, how to avoid them in the future, and it has been going on for a decade in the United Nations. And those were the difficult times when I was UN Special Rapporteur on freedom of religion. On the one hand, there was the OIC, who insisted that every country should have a law on defamation of religion, and that defamation of religion should be accepted as a human rights right. Now, my position on that was very clear. I think religions don't have rights. It is people who have rights. And I also believe that when you make defamation of religion into a human rights, you actually dent the whole framework, the human rights framework. You asphyxiate debate and research. And yet you continuously see that domestic legislation does exist, not as the defamation of religion, but forms of anti-conversion laws or blasphemy laws. They do exist in my country, but they also exist in many mature democracies. And once you make a law in the name of religion, it takes decades and generations to get rid of that law. Witness, for example, the law in UK on blasphemy. It took many decades to undo that law, despite the fact that nobody ever used it. But it was considered almost blasphemy to undo that law.